Deborah.
So, as oftentimes happens when I'm preparing myself for worship, I sometimes need a little pick-me-up. Thank you, Stephen. Truly wonderful. And the choir so often does that. Angie so often does that with our music, and I'm just so utterly grateful. Thank you for that. The folks that gather with together on Tuesdays to discuss the lectionary know that oftentimes as we're reading through them, I am either one of two things, utterly confused and have no idea what I'm going to preach on, or I find that there are so many things in the scriptures that I don't know where to preach on because there's so much to do. And the scriptures we had today were absolutely and utterly rich in that. I mean, think for what Deborah just read for us, Jesus, the New Testament reading, and Jesus there with the Pharisees, and he goes in this whole treatise on the law in which he says that, do you not know that Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath? And I looked at that, and oh my gosh, the places we could go as we think about the law. Or think about what was the beginning of the Hebrew Scriptures, where we read these words, that the Word of God was rare and visions were not widespread. And I read that and I go, why? Why? And I want to know why, and I want to know, is that similar to what our day is? But I'm not going to go to any of those things, because what I was really intrigued by in the scriptures is this passing of the baton that goes on between Eli and Samuel. Eli is quite old at the time of the story that we hear in the Hebrew scripture, and Eli has been the man. Eli has been the high priest, the judge, which is the ruler of the people at that time, the oracle, the one in whom God speaks to, but Eli's days are dimming. It says that the fire of the Lord had not yet gone out, implying that it was soon to go out. And for various reasons, Eli is not being heard that much anymore. Caring for him is a young man, Samuel, who cares deeply for Eli. But at the start of the story, we hear this about Samuel, that we hear that the word of God had not yet been revealed to him. But in this story, that's all about to change. Three different times, God calls out to Samuel, 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 Samuel. And each time, Samuel assumes that it is Eli that is speaking to him each time, goes to Eli and says, what, Lord, what do you want? And Eli says, not me. Wasn't I calling you? What's going on with this young man? I don't know. Finally, Eli figures it out and says to Samuel, says, next time you hear it, it's God who is calling you. And your answer when God calls you is to say, here I am, Lord. Speak. Your servant listens. And that's exactly what happens. Samuel is about to have the baton passed to him from Eli to him. From God to Eli to him, because Samuel is about to become the one for whom the nation will turn to, the one who will speak for the nation, the one who will intercede with God for the nation. It is Samuel who generations later is going to be the one that finds this young shepherd boy by the name of David and realizes that this is who God has decided will be the king, the one that will lead Israel, the people of Israel, the chosen people to their promised time, their golden era. And it is not that Eli's thinking is no longer valid. But simply as we say, as we hear said in the United Church of Christ often, God is still speaking. And don't put a period where God has inserted a comma. I liken it to food. My mother, who is sitting right here next to Kirsten, is a wonderful cook. As a child growing up, she cooked amazing food for us, kept us well fed and nourished and everything else. And I learned to love to cook from my mother. I'll be the first to tell you that I don't cook like her at all. At all. In fact, the things that are in our spice cabinet do not have any resemblance to the things, for the most part, that are in my mom's spice cabinet, other than salt and pepper that we share in common. After that, nothing more. The things that I love to cook, the things that when I went through my vegan period and my vegetarian period and my paleo period and this period and that period, all when my mother and father would come over to eat, I'm sure confused them just a little bit. And it had nothing to do with a rejection of my mother's food. It had to do with my deepening love for food, my deepening exploration for food. And it did not in any way diminish my love for food. In fact, what it did was it deepened that ability for me to not only love it, but to understand not only how it could nourish the body, but nourish the soul and nourish a community and nourish a world. That in fact, if I want to change the world, I just need to change the way in which we eat, the way in which we grow our food, consume our food, and what we do with it. And so I am eternally grateful to my mother for helping me to learn and to love to cook. But I have moved on from the cooking that my mother did when I was a child. And so it is that Samuel becomes a voice that needs to be heard. And I realized as I read this story how essential it is to be hearing new voices that will lead us to deeper places, more profound understandings of God, and an expanded perception of our own call. So this morning, I want to share with you some of these new voices. And to do so is to not reject some of the voices that I have always loved. In fact, just this morning in the adult ed class, Mark gave us this document, which I know you all can read from where you are. And it is this statement, a celebration of faith in a time of crisis. And it is signed by these wonderful men and women, leaders of various denominations, various faith organizations that claim to be elders within our community. And in fact, they are. They're all older than me, which isn't that old anymore. And I love what they write here. And I love some of the theologians that are very familiar to so many of you. You all know, if you were part of our Lenten study, how much I love me some Marcus Borg and some John Dominic Crossan. How much I love folks like Phyllis Trickle and Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza. These are wonderful women theologians that have shaped my life. How much I love people like Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi, Dorothy Day. And I do not mean in any way to diminish the impact of those folks upon my life. If you were to go into my office and look at the scores of books that are on my shelves, they are all filled with those voices. And I realize as I read this story of Eli and Samuel that it's about time to add some new voices. And so I want to share just a few with you. A good friend of mine who is another Episcopal Service Corps director in Sacramento, the Reverend Casey Klein, a Lutheran pastor, said it became her task for a year to read fewer old white dudes. If you go to seminary, you read a lot of old white dudes. And she realized it was time to do that. And I decided, as I was researching and pulling this sermon together, I had to pull myself back because there were so many non-older white dudes that we needed to read. And so I put into your bulletin, there is a bit of an insert of some folks that I'm going to lift up today. And I put it in there so that you could have a visual of what they look like, so that you could read some things of which they have written, or which are not the things I am going to read of them today, and that you might in fact see internet information so that you can look them up later and carry on your education along with me. So first, let's just think about this woman who's the second one down there. You see Shane Claiborne, that's who I quoted this morning. Nadia Boltz-Weber. Any of you heard of Nadia Boltz-Weber? There's a few. You need to hear of Nadia Boltz-Weber. She will shock you. She will shock you in so many ways by her appearance. She is tatted up left, right, and all over her body. She swears like a sailor. She is a recovering severe addict. She's a Lutheran priest, founding pastor of a House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver, Colorado, and she's the author of a New York Times bestseller, Accidental Saints, finding God in all the wrong places. And I want to share with you a quote from Nadia Boltz-Weber. And this is a quote that came out about a year ago. Some of you may remember that there were a group of conservative evangelical pastors that got together and theologians that got together in the wonderful city of Nashville, I think it was last fall, and they issued what's called the Nashville Statement. And the Nashville Statement was their understanding of the Bible in terms of issues that have to do with the LGBT community, and you can well imagine that it was not a statement, though couched in lovely and beautiful language, that was particularly friendly or supportive of the LGBT community. And there were many folks that responded to that with a very different perspective, and she is one of them. And she writes, in response to that Nashville Statement, she wrote these words: "Many deny that God created all human beings for God's glory and believe that God's good purposes for us are limited to those whose personal, physical design is cisgendered, heterosexual, and socially acceptable expressions of male and female. However, many Christians now understand that such binary and backwards thinking excludes a large and important part of God's beautiful plan for God's people. The pathway to full and lasting joy through God's good design for God's creatures is clearly inclusive of a variety of identities of gender and expressions of sexuality that had previously been denied by short-sighted and limited thinking, teaching, and preaching that has ruined lives and dishonored God." Now, the old white dudes that are the books in my office might very well appreciate what Nadia Boltz-Weber wrote. But a generation, two generations ago, when those authors were at their height, these were not the issues they were dealing with. This was not the world in which they lived. These were mainstream non-issues. Not any longer, thanks to people like Nadia Boltz-Weber. Valerie Kaur, you can see her picture there on that insert. Valerie Kaur is a woman. She is not a Christian woman. She is a Sikh. I have quoted Valerie Kaur one time before when I was not yet your pastor. And when I spoke of it, it was when Valerie Kaur, on New Year's Eve of 2016, 3 weeks before the inauguration of our latest president of the United States, in amongst a group of folks that were concerned about the direction the country may be moving as a result of the election that happened, and she spoke about the reality that perhaps we look at this time of darkness, as she said, as a tomb, but perhaps we need to reframe our thinking and see it as a womb. And to understand that from out of that womb comes life, and that first you must breathe and then you must push. And it was a call to action that I found powerful, found ennobling, and called me in many ways to want to stand right here amongst you. She is a civil rights activist, a lawyer, a faith leader, a filmmaker, founder of the Revolutionary Love Project and the Grounds Movement, an online community of people who believe that faith can be a force for good in the world. And this is what she writes. "Love calls us to look upon the faces of those different from our brothers and sisters. Love calls us to look upon the faces of those different from us as brothers and sisters. Love calls us to weep when their bodies are outcast, broken, or destroyed. Love calls us to speak even when our voice trembles, stand even when hate spins out of control, and stay even when the blood is flesh on the ground. Love makes us brave. The world needs your love, the only social, political, and moral force that can dismantle injustice to make the world around us and within us. The world needs your love, the only social, political, and moral force that can dismantle injustice to remake the world around us and within us. To pursue a life of revolutionary love is to walk boldly into the hot winds of the world with saints' eyes and a warrior's heart." What a phrase. To walk boldly into the hot winds of the world with a saint's eyes and a warrior's heart, and pour our body, breath, and blood into others. I have watched her YouTube videos of her speaking and preaching, and almost every time find myself moved to tears. So profound, so inspiring, and so challenging are her words, speaking to the universal call of faith, of all faiths, to a call of a love that is, as she says, the only social, political, and moral force that can dismantle injustice. There's another picture there, a young woman by the name of Austin Channing Brown. She's the author of a book called I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness. She is one of many powerful young African-American women that are calling our nation to look at what Dr. Martin Luther King called our original sin, that of racism, and the way in which it permeates through all parts of our life. She talks about in her books how white middle class, mostly evangelical, how the white middle class, mostly evangelical world has participated in an era of rising racial hostility. And she invites we who would read to confront apathy, to recognize God's ongoing work in the world, and discover how blackness, if we let it, can indeed save us all. She is a person committed, as so many of us are, to exploring the intersections of racial justice, faith, and black womanhood. And she wrote this, these words that I want to share with you, right after Charlottesville, right after the marches in Charlottesville that left one person dead and scores injured, right after that march in which the response from our highest office was to tweet out that there are good people on both sides of this issue. She writes, "My friends," echoing Dr. Martin Luther King in so many ways, "you have got to let go of this idea that you can sit in the middle, not choose sides, condemn everyone equally, and be on the side of Jesus. You can be nuanced in your thinking, but you must choose to stand either with an ideology of peace and love or an ideology of violence and hate. Choose this day." As I sit here, she writes, "I'm imagining what the news stories that may have been written after Jesus went into the temple and led a one-man protest. I wonder if the newspapers called him violent for turning over all the furniture. I wonder if local reporters said that everything was fine until he had come and caused all that chaos. I wonder if government leaders condemned his actions and called it a riot. I wonder if no one chose to report about the people who came to him afterwards, the poor, the children, the sick. I wonder if Jesus' declaration that the temple would be a house of prayer for all nations rubbed some folks just the wrong way. I wonder if it felt like losing power. I wonder if it felt like an affront, a break with how things had always been. I wonder if anyone pointed out that the money changers, at least they had permits, but Jesus did not. And tonight," she says, "I wonder how many of you would have condemned Christ, proclaiming that there were problems on both sides. Sure, the money changers should have been treating people unjustly, but then again, Jesus could have found a better way, couldn't he? A quieter way, a less violent way, a kind way, a patient way, a more polite way, a more reasonable way, a more acceptable way, a less chaotic way to handle the situation. Beloved," she says, "Jesus stood on the side of the marginalized over and over and over and over again, and we are called to stand there with them." She is a person who challenges the status quo. She shakes up our desire for nicety. She confronts the "can't we all get along" philosophy that we would love to have. That "in your face with love" is not something that I am used to, I must admit. But it intrigues me, and it calls to me. And lastly, let me lift up one other voice. Right here, right up the road at the University of Hawaii, getting her PhD, Jamaica Osorio. She got it. My bad. She needs to update her website. She is an award-winning slam poet. And I encourage you, look at that website there and look at her delivery of some of the poetry. And I'm going to share a bit of one called Kumulipo, not all of it. I can't do it justice, can't do it in the way in which she would deliver it, but I want to share these words to you. It was written when she was an undergraduate student at Stanford. And what I will not share, because it goes on longer and longer, and in Hawaiian that is beyond my abilities, is her retracing, as in the Kumulipo, the Hawaiian creation chant, her own Hawaiian genealogy that she is very afraid that she might one day forget. So she writes this poetry, Kumulipo. What happens to the ones forgotten, the ones who shape my heart from their rib cages? I want to taste the tears in their names, trace their souls into my vocal cords so that I can feel related again, because I have forgotten my own grandparents' middle names, forgotten what color thread God used to sew me together with. There is a culture somewhere beneath my skin that I've been searching for since I landed here, but it's hard to feel sometimes, because at Stanford we are innovative. The city of Macintosh breeds thinkers of tomorrow, and I have forgotten how to remember. But our roots cannot remember themselves, cannot remember how to dance if we don't chant for them, and will not sing unless we are listening, but our tongues feel too foreign in our own mouths. We don't dare speak out loud, and we can't even remember our own parents' names. So who will remember mine if I don't teach them? Her poetry, Jamaica's poetry, and her presence and her delivery has a spiritual resonance without the spiritual language that we have become so used to. She speaks for generations of a host culture that is weary of the tired fights. She speaks for those who are grounded in the old ways, yet ready to demand what was taken and ready to shape a future that all of us, regardless of our genealogy, will be better for. I hope that you noticed that the people that shared were all women. And I hope that you noticed that only one of them actually is a professional theologian, Reverend Nadia Boltz Weber. The rest of them are not. And I hope that you noticed only one of them is white. The rest of them are women of color. And I hope that you noticed that two of the four are not people that identify themselves as Christians. And I hope that as I stand here before the table and you think about all those things that I said, that I hope that you hope that you noticed, you would realize that if Jesus were standing right here at the table, which indeed he is, all of those women would be welcome at this table. And in fact, I cannot imagine a more engaging and fascinating conversation than would happen at that table with Jesus and those women and the so many other young voices for whom the baton is being passed to. Voices that we need to listen to and hear, and I hope that you would realize that sitting right here around the table, Jesus would engage all of them as Jesus engages all of us and welcome us and invite us to the table, that we might be challenged, that we might be intrigued, that we might be moved. And there is nothing wrong with that which has shaped us, that has brought us to this place. But if we ever allow ourselves to be at this table, in this place, complacent, as if we have heard it all and know it all, then we have put God into a little box that is under our control. And so it is important, that Eli passed the baton to Samuel, that Marcus Borg passed the baton to Nadia Boltz Weber, that Martin Luther King passed the baton to Shane Austin Weber, I believe. Her name just slipped me, I apologize. That the baton be passed, and that we hear in their words and in their presence the call to be the people that God has called us to be. And so we, with them, and those that have gone before them, and those that will follow, gather around this table. And we bring to this table as well, and this is a little bit of a shift in the way in which we have been doing our order of worship. We bring to the table as well one another and the prayers of our hearts and minds. And so before we continue on, and as we think of those wonderful women and so many others who gather around this table with us, I want to ask you all, are there prayers that you would have shared of folks that we too bring to this table, our joys, our concerns? What would we lift up? Liz?
I got a call from you.